Let's start by recalling what we did last time. So what we did was to try to understand the relationship between these covariant methods and the usual canonical methods on the usual phase space. So the picture we have is that of a closed universe evolved in time. So we have a globally hyperbolic manifold, and then is my normal. We have no boundaries for sigma in this setup. Now, on M, at the covariance level, we started from a space of off-shell covariant histories that co-covariant configurations, which is the space that we use to write our action. So this space usually is relatively nice, but it contains, of course, if we want to study physics, we need to look at the space of solutions. So this is obtained by solving the equations of motion and is a subspace of this space. Now, this space is in a precise sense, in fact, non-local, because you cannot change the value of your fields as you want locally in space-time, because the equations of motion would actually propagate these disturbances. So an important thing about, but this is where physics happens. So what is the relationship between this way of thinking about phase space as the space of on-shell histories with the usual way of thinking about phase space? Well, we found out that in theories without gauge symmetries, it's usually quite easy to relate the usual phase space to this phase space, because there is a one-to-one correspondence between the space of on-shell histories with the space of initial data, which appear in these in the phase space that can be constructed by taking the off-shell phase space, restricting it to sigma, we integrate omega, and then we do presymplectic reduction, which is this procedure I described last time. And we obtain, by construction, a phase space. And we notice that for a particle, a scalar field theory, this is precisely in one-to-one correspondence with the. Well, one can prove that in this case, there is a correspondence between an isomorphism between the phase space defined here and up there. But for gauge theory, this is not the case. And the problem is that I wrote it here, there are constraints. So what are these constraints? They're the bulk part of the neutral current projected on sigma. And these are quantities that must vanish on shell. So configurations that do not satisfy, or I should say initial data, in quotes, that do not satisfy this constraint cannot be viable initial conditions for your dynamical problem. And so you need to impose these extra conditions. So inside your off-shell phase space, in general, there is another space of configurations of in here that satisfy the constraint. But then this space will not be symplectic, because we are removing some directions, but we're not doing for example, in electromagnetism, we're saying that the electric field must be divergence free, but we're saying nothing about A, which is the conjugate variable. So there is a mismatch. And how to solve that mismatch? We see that we have to quotient out the gauge freedom. So this is quotienting out gauge. And how do we see the relation between the two? Well, let's say in a simple case, the relationship is due to the fact to this. Let's forget the complicated cases where there are extra terms. We see that when we write this down in the off-shell phase space, if everything works well, like Fourier and Mills, sorry, I changed notation a bit. So this guy must vanish because of the constraints. So we see that on the constraint surface, omega of will have a kernel, which is precisely given by the gauge transformations. So this all comes together. In fact, the origin of the constraints was the gauge freedom in the first place, and so on. So everything is actually perfectly consistent. And so this is modding out gauge. We find that we can build a new phase space, which is called the physical phase space or the reduced phase space, which is obtained from the off-shell one by imposing the constraint and modding out gauge. Now, this step, these two steps together are called symplectic reduction of the constraints. And it's relevant in gauge theories. Otherwise, there would be immediately an identity. One last remark, which is very important regarding this on-shell business. It's especially important to go on-shell because on-shell we have the conservation of the covariant symplectic current. This is one of the first results we found. And which means that if we integrate this quantity on sigma, it actually does not depend on sigma. So this on-shell phase space will be in some sense the same. There will be isomorphism given by the evolution, in fact, between different choice between the phase space that we would be at different choices of sigma. It's not guaranteed a priori in here because we're working off shell. So a priori there is no relationship between this choice of sigma and this choice of sigma. Okay, so I hope this summarizes last time discussion. And today we try to apply these. We applied it to Young Mills. We'll try to apply it to gravity. Are there questions about it? So here I wrote, for reference, the example of the time translations for the scalar field. I will come back to it in a second. The only thing I want you to remember is that this was a case where, although we think we have a symmetry, which is time translations, we see that off shell, this symmetry is not Hamiltonian, right? Because there is this extra obstruction, which is proportional to the equations of motion. And the idea, again, is that time translations are about changing the surface. So unless we go on shell, there is no reason why there should be a relationship between what is happening here and up there. And so we cannot expect that these symmetries are Hamiltonian off shell. But this will have an analogy in gravity, and we will see that's why I wrote it. OK, now we can start with GR. These are formulas that I had already written, and today we have to manipulate them a little bit further to be able to talk about canonical GR. So these are the covariant expressions. Now we want to find the expressions for P off. Oh, one thing that I mentioned but I didn't repeat today is that the space that is easy to quantize usually is P off. Like these on-shell phase spaces are much harder to access. So what one usually does in a theory like Young-Mills, you quantize things in P off, then you impose, try to find a way to impose your symmetries quantum mechanically. And then, since doing quantum theory is complicated if the theory is nonlinear, what you do is to impose your symmetries exactly somehow and do perturbative dynamics on top. This has this poses some serious issues in GR because, as we will see, symmetries and dynamics are extremely intertwined. So one of the big, maybe a way to summarize why it's so hard to do canonical GR is quantum gravity, is because you can't impose the symmetries and do perturbative dynamics. The theory is nonlinear. So thinking that you can solve the theory and quantize it exactly is crazy in the first place. So you need to find some tricks. But now, since the dynamics is the symmetries in a very precise sense that I hope I will discuss at the end, the machine kind of breaks because you want to impose the symmetries precisely to be able to describe the true phase space. But on the other hand, to do that, you have to solve a nonlinear system. So that's a big difference with other theories. Okay, so canonical GR. So here we're writing things in terms of the space-time variables. What we need to do is to do a 3+1 decomposition at sigma. And I hope you have already seen some of these because I will not have the time to go into the details. But the main protagonists of this split are Hij, which is the induced metric on sigma. Then there is the normal notice that the normal depends on the choice of sigma, but also on the choice of the metric, right? So if I change the metric, the normal will change. So, and then there is chi aj. Well, I should call it pi, so I introduce it immediately. So this is square root of h chi aj minus K I j, where K I j is equal to the extrinsic curvature. Of sigma. So quantities that write with the ij indices are 3D tensors. And this is essentially ln hij, which, well, maybe I call it hab, and this is which is essentially h dot, right? So this is a densitized, this is a tensor, this is densitized because it contains the volume factor in front. As I said the other time, we need to take the whole package to have a momentum, a well-defined momentum, so that our symplectic structure will be d pi ij d delta ij plus, if I'm coming from this one, there will be, plus corner terms, which I ignore because we are in the case d sigma equals zero. So I'm skipping quite a few details, of course, but in principle, it's just a straightforward computation, which is not really straightforward, but it's just a computation. So this kappa, this k, essentially is the time derivative of our intrinsic metric. So is what we would expect to be the momentum in this setup. Except that it comes in this more complicated combination, but it is what it is. Now, as you can see, there is no NA appearing. Okay, so this is similar to what happens for a knot. Similar to a knot in Young Mills. We didn't have a knot in Young Mills theory in the phase space. It was just E and the tangential A's. Here is the same story. These are can be decomposed into laps and shift if I want to do a 3D split of N. And so, again, laps and shift do not appear in the canonical phase space. Okay.
Why is this important? Why is this important that NA doesn't appear?
Well. First is an observation, so it's a fact. It's important. It's not so easy to say why it is important, but it relates to. It's not obviously related, but it plays into the fact that normal diffeos are special. So this is the next remark. And then we can go back to your question. Remark. So we split the diffeomorphisms into let me write it like this. It's not the best way. Well, no, okay. Let me write it like this. X plus I'm a bit at loss with which letters to choose. Let's say beta. No, beta I don't like. Lambda. Lambda n. OK, so this is a vector. So this is a vector on, is a section of tangent m. This is a section of tangent sigma, is a parallel vector. And this is, of course, the normal. So I'm doing a normal split of xi with respect to my surface. What is the issue here? The issue here is that specifying what is normal, what is tangent, can be done without any reference to the normal direction. It's an intrinsic property of the vector. So intrinsic notion to sigma. Whereas to specify the normal, what is normal, I need the normal. I need to know this other quantity. So this projection cannot be expressed within phase space, in a sense. You see? This is a field-dependent notion, depends on my configuration. JB and cannot be projected, cannot be I don't know how to projected on the canonical phase space. Because N does not appear there, is due to this observation down here.
So it's like saying that omega is completely intrinsic to sigma. It doesn't see anything outside of that.
Well, there is this pi, but this pi, it is what it is. You cannot, it doesn't contain, it is related to the normal, but you cannot reconstruct the normal out of it. Okay, so this is why this plays a role, in fact. We start seeing that these normal diffeos will be painful, will be actually not so easy to deal with. Okay, so we have our let's call these symmetries. We have our phase space, we have our symmetries, now we need the constraints. So the constraints can be read out of J. So the constraints, let me write them like this, are equal to at sigma. So let's say at sigma. They are given by NA JA Xi, in a sense, the bulk part. Okay, this can be made precise. We had seen that there is always a constraint part that vanishes on shell plus some total divergence. And so here we mean this piece. So it's the normal component of that, which is the normal component of the equations of motion, in fact. Okay. So this becomes NA, NB, GAB plus lambda GAB times lambda, plus we have NA, if we want HBI GAB plus lambda GAB XI. So this is the Hamiltonian constraint, so we can maybe write them integrated. Well, because it's just more common to write these things integrated, but well, let's call it H for Hamiltonian constraint. And this is the tangential part is the vector constraint V. So let me write them. So to do this again, it's a bit of a pain because you need to take this nice covariant expression and break them down in 3 plus 1. So after 3 plus 1 split of Einstein's equations, so you need the Gauss-Kodaty, Minardi equations to do this. What you obtain is that H of lambda becomes the, well, H, let's just, H is equal to, well, let's start from V. V is simple. V is equal to the divergence, so we need an index I because it's contracted with X. And this is given by the 3D divergence of pi aj. So, well, depending. This is essentially, remember, this is densitized. So the fact that here there is a normal derivative is essentially because I'm plugging in the square root of h. If I want to pull it out, I can write it as a covariant derivative. It just depends on. Okay, so this looks precisely like the Gauss constraint, where you remember the Gauss constraint in Young-Mills, we would have Ea, and the Gauss constraint is divergence of E. And then we have the Hamiltonian constraint, which it's always a pleasure to write down. Okay, so here you go. So this means that both indices are contracted. Well, this is, well, I can write it with indices. KL, KL, whereas this is KK squared. That's what it meant. So you can see that these here implicitly there is the metric appearing because I'm contracting the pi's here too. This is a big nonlinear function of the metric. There are square roots of the determinant of the metric, inverse square roots of the determinant of the metric. This is not a fun object to quantize because it has all sorts of nonlinear operator ordering ambiguities. So it's crazy, crazy hard, and it's kind of desperate, in fact, that there's probably no point in even trying too hard unless you're linearizing and looking at something like that. Part of the power of this Ashtekar variable that we're looking in the tutorial is to make this expression way, way, way simpler. It's still hard, but is incomparably simpler than this. Okay, so a little note. Imposing this constraint quantum mechanically means imposing 3D different variants. Imposing this is imposing the Hamiltonian constraint, and this is this equation that imposes the Hamiltonian constraint is called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So this is, if you side note, h hat psi, whatever this means, because as I said, quantizing h hat is extremely challenging, but whatever this means, h hat psi equals zero is the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. I think. But you can call it the Wheeler-DeWitt equation no matter which variables you're expressing it. So for example, in Ashtekar variables, there is also a big debate how to quantize H appropriately. It's not an easy task either, but is much, much more treatable than in metric variables. Okay, so let's go back to our flow equation. So we have all the ingredients, right? So we have P off, and now essentially we want to see how to go towards the right red box. We have everything we need on the left. So the easy one is 3D diffeos. So the vector constraint. And why? The reason is that, as I remarked, first we're not looking at this term. As I said, we're setting this to zero because we don't care about corners. So sigma here, so we have this integral over sigma, and as we remarked a few times, this means that this survives only if xi is normal to sigma or transverse. Okay? So if you're just looking at the tangential xi's, this term will not appear. And then we're really happy because we have everything that is expressible in terms of our phase space variables. Oh, a very important remark. It's quite non-trivial that here n never appears. So n only appears inside pi very implicitly, but we don't need n on its own. We need it, so it's kind of a magic, right? We need it for the split of Xi, but once we have done it, n does not appear anymore inside there. So this is an important remark. But let's go back to 3D diffeos. So everything projects nicely. So we have I, so this equation here projects nicely onto P off and reads I, let's say rho of x omega off equal minus d integral of vi xi, and that's it. So a remark, I mentioned it in words, this rocks, this action is exactly what you would expect because those are, as I said, h is a 3D tensor, pi is a 3D tensor density, so they have their own way of transforming, which is what you would guess by taking Lie derivatives and stuff like this. So this action is natural. There's no problem with that. Let's say acts h and k, let me write it like this, are tensors, are 3D tensors. So we know how those transform, and if you can check that everything works nicely. So here we are in precisely in the same situation as in Yang-Mills theory. Everything projects all right. We have our Gauss-looking constraints. Everything is pretty straightforward. So and in fact, we can also check, this is something we also did quite some time ago. We had, we know that once we have a Hamiltonian flow equation like this, there is always a bracket between the charges. So here I'm indicating this integral. This is just a common notation to say that I'm integrating it. So I can take the Poisson bracket between these two with respect to this symplectic structure. So if you want, it's the off symplectic structure. And this gives the Lie bracket between x and y. So there is a representation of the Lie algebra you would expect to find. And importantly, defined with is the diff 3 Lie algebra bracket. You don't does not depend on the metric nor the extrinsic curvature. So it's an intrinsic object to the Lie algebra of diffeomorphism. Right? I can compute this bracket just by there's no metric appearing anywhere in this expression. Okay, so we fix this. Now, what happens to the other one? Well, the other one, as you can expect, will create us some problems. So this is, in this form, the first observer, it is Lee and Wald in 91, at least as far as I know. So they say, they observe that normal diffeos, so more, there are two ways of phrasing this. So the way they phrase it is, they say, the action of normal diffeos does not project down to P off. And this is not very surprising. The reason is, we said it many times, these normal diffeos are changing our surface. And so the reason, roughly speaking, is the same as there for the scalar field. So if we want the action on of time translations on phi and phi dot, this will be phi dot and phi dot dot. So phi dot dot is not a function on the phase space, it's the equations of motion, which we can set it to zero to find the on-shell configurations. But off-shell is a completely new quantity, right? So reason h dot dot, so let's say rho lambda in n on h, sorry, on pi, on what do I want to say? On h goes like h dot, is essentially h dot, which is k, okay? Whereas, so we can express it in terms of our phase space variables, but the problem is that we also have lambda with pi. And this will be an h dot dot dot, or a pi dot, which doesn't really either one. Not a phase space variable. And it's not, there's no combination of the phase space variables that can give you this quantity. Because it is related to the equations of motion. It's exactly what is happening up there. It's not different in this respect. The equations of motion is precisely the thing that tells you what is pi dot, right? So without using them, you can't, you're stuck. What is pi dot in terms of h and pi? So. Of not not a phase space variable. Well, so this is equations of motion relate these quantity to pi and h. And in fact, this is precisely what we see. If we look at the flow equation, in this case, we do have the equations of motion surviving. So a different way of seeing that things do not work. So in this picture, we focus on the left-hand side by thinking about rho. But even looking at the right-hand side, we see that although we can nicely project this term, because we have this expression, this term does not project on the phase space for the very same reason, of course, because the left-hand side is equal to the right-hand side. So, but it's a different, in one case, we look at the action of the symmetries and we realize that is not projectable. In the other case, we just see that the flow equation cannot be projected, the right-hand side of the flow equation cannot be projected. And the origin is the same, is the presence of these h dot dots. So I shouldn't really great pi. Well, it's fine. I think for at this level, it's fine. Is this clear? Because this is the key point, in fact, of why of what goes on in gravity. So another way of saying this is that there is no charge generating there is no charge on P off well even more strongly there is no representation of 4D diffeos on the, oh, I didn't say the name. This phase space is called ADM phase space. This pi and h is the ADM phase space. From Arnovit, Deser, and Misner on the ADM. On the canonical, well, in fact, ADM is usually if one says ADM, what one means is the phase space expressed in these variables. But in fact, this is a more general statement. In any canonical, if it's on the canonical phase space of GR. And here I mean the off-shell one, of course. Okay, because in the on-shell one, it doesn't even make a ton of sense because we are modding out these diffeos. So this is the problem. We do not. If you think about four-dimensional diffeos, canonically speaking, they do not make sense. You can have 3D diffeos, all right, but normal diffeos, you just cannot represent them on your canonical on your canonical phase space in your canonical variables, and the problem comes down to this, that you would need second-order time derivatives, and they are inaccessible in phase space. Yes?
So what if we don't work on the ADM space links, even then?
Well, this type of equation, if you remember how we derived it, we only use general covariance. So even if you don't have a precise description of what these rho xi are, you would still find this same right-hand side, which I would say is essentially proof that this is completely independent of the variables you choose to describe your phase space in. In fact, any other variable will be some crazy combination of these h and pi's, or vice versa. So you can. The Ashtekar variables are some. In fact, is a. You can build the Ashtekar variables as a canonical transformation of these phase space variables. You just find new combinations that have nicer properties and that make this horrible expression way, way simpler. But other than that, you're working on the same, you're just using different coordinates to describe the same space. Yeah.
But what's the difference between this? This time translation, this time direction local symmetry as compared to the parameterized particle case?
Oh, really good question. So if you, good, thanks for this question. So this H constraint is analogous to the constraint we have in the parameterized particle case. And indeed, yeah, so the difference is that in this case it's quadratic in pi. So one first question is, if I were very smart, could I find some ways of turning this into a linear constraint for some other variable, and so look at GR as a parameterized theory, like just like the particle, but much more complicated? And the answer is, well, I don't think there is a theorem, but lots of trial and errors says, no, it's not possible. It might even be provable as a statement, but it should be made precise first. But so it's, that's why the parameterized particle was introduced as a toy model, because it looks similar, it has similar conceptual issues. However, if you do the covariant phase space analysis of the parameterized particle, quite funnily, you fall directly on the usual phase space. But I think I don't quite understand the deep reasons why that works. But I suspect the fact is that maybe the relativistic particle is different, but the Newtonian parameterized particle, you could see it as having introduced the parametrization completely by hand, and somehow it gets undone on its own. I don't have a really good answer, but you fall directly on the usual P's and Q's. It's a good toy model for certain things, but not for all of them.
But in that sense, for the off-shell phase space of the parameterized particle, is there a representation for the time?
Well, you get, I see. Oh, no, in that, okay. Can we discuss later? Because I haven't, it's been a year I have done the exercise, so I don't remember the entire details. But the point is, here your action looks really like pi square minus something, whereas in the parameterized particle, you have also some T dots under at the denominator, so it's structurally a bit different than. So one should be a bit careful. It's not so obvious what, but we can check. I do have the computations done, so and we can check. Okay, so, but we should not despair. This is not the end of the story. So we still have a vector constraint, a Hamiltonian constraint, we have a Poisson bracket. At the very least, we should check whether what happens if we take Poisson brackets between these objects. Because there is no problem in looking at what do you want to say? In looking at a symplectic flow of H. We can still do that. We have a function on phase space. We can look at this bracket with the other objects. So, so this is the new chapter, the Dirac hypersurface deformation algebra. So we can still, as I said, look at this type of my signs might be all over the place. Don't trust them. So what should we expect from here? Of course, these are computations that one can do explicitly, but this one we can guess. We can guess because this is the generator of 3D diffuse. These are all tensorial quantities appearing in H. So we know how H should transform. There cannot be any surprise here. H must transform as a scalar. Okay? A scalar density, in fact. So here is double density divided by one density, whereas here is a density. So long story short, this becomes H again, but for the transformed for the transform parameter, because this H of X is just the integral of this mirror with something. So if this transforms as a scalar, we can integrate by part and put the derivative on the parameter. Okay, it's like the equivariance of the map. So this is because H is a scalar density under 3D diffuse. Of course, the surprise is what happens when we take two Hamiltonian constraints between themselves. So here, this is a painful computation, as you can imagine. But the result is the following. We get something proportional to V. If you want, roughly speaking, this is like the Poincaré algebra. The Lorentz algebra. You have rotations. You have rotations on a boost, giving a rotated boost. And you have two boosts giving a rotation. So because, locally, you can use, you can specialize this type of algebra to that of killing symmetries for Minkowski, and then it should give you back the Poincaré. But anyway, the peculiarity is that this new parameter, I will write it somewhere else, because I need a bit more space. So let me call it zeta. So what is this zeta? So I should actually write it zeta of h, because it will depend on h. And this is hij lambda, because we want a vector, right? So, I should call it z, not, just to be consistent with my own notation. So this is zi. We need a vector, and the only way to build it out of what we have is this one. But the point is that depends on the configuration we are at. So in fact, although this is called the Dirac hypersurface deformation algebra, it is not an algebra. And it is not an algebra because the structure constants are not constant, but they depend on the configuration we're looking at. So whereas these two can be computed without any reference up to the metric, this one depends on where we are on phase space. So this is not an algebra. And it's not even an algebraoid, despite what some people say, because algebraoids have a technical definition which does not match this structure. In case you hear these things, okay, so so the question now is, okay, this stuff, this algebra closes, this algebra of constraint closes. Algebra of constraints closes. And closes means that it's involutive. It means that if I take the bracket of two constraints, I get another constraint. So I can consistently put them to zero in phase space. Because suppose that here I got a constant, it would not make sense to set this to zero and then I take the Poisson bracket of two things that should be zero, and I get something that is non-zero. So the only way to impose constraint consistently is that they close. Otherwise, there are problems. You can see it also geometrically, but it basically tells you that the flows of these, the Hamiltonian flows of the constraints, are tangent to the constraint surface. Hamiltonian flows of constraints tangent to C in P of. And so we can quotient them. We can still define a reduced phase space by quotienting the direction along these flows. C modulo the flow of the constraint. So it's something that makes sense, and so we can still do it. As you can see, it becomes very abstract though, and it's quite challenging to describe this reduced phase space in this case. So reducing V is relatively simple, also conceptually. You get the 3D geometries abstractly, not in coordinates, because you have removed the 3D invariant. So you're like saying, oh, the space of 3D geometries up to 3D diffeos is sometimes called Riemann sigma, is the space of Riemannian structure and sigma in an abstract sense, and it is the arena on which Hamiltonian GR happens. The difficulties is then implementing the Hamiltonian constraint in this space. Okay, I want to conclude just a couple more minutes on an interesting theorem. So this is an algebra so what is the geometrical meaning of this algebra? We said this cannot be four-dimensional diffeos. This is not the algebra of four-dimensional diffeos. It's not even representing an algebra because of this. So this, as the name says, this can be derived abstractly as the algebra of deformations of your surface, which is closely related to diffeos, but is not diffeos strictly speaking. So the question is, once we impose that and we go on shell and reduce, is this the same story as having reduced 4D diffeos up in the top right corner? Right now we have gone down and to the right, but we could also have done the opposite. Impose the equation of motion and coming down there. And the answer is yes. You can you can show that on shell of the constraints, implementing this algebra is the same thing as implementing diffeomorphic symmetry. In fact, and you can wonder, but here I'm just using the constraints. Where's the dynamics? I've never imposed the dynamics. The point is, these constraints do not only encode the symmetries of the theory, they encode the dynamics of the theory just as well. So this is a theorem by Kokash, Hoschmann, and Teitelbaum. It's actually a very strong theorem that says that modulo technical assumptions take P of to be pi and h. with the obvious symplectic structure, then there exist unique functions v of h and pi and h of h and pi such that they satisfy the Dirac hypersurface deformation algebra. So you don't even need to know, well, there are technical hypotheses, something like this object should be at most quadratic in pi, things like this. Modulo technical. So this is a bit like Lovelock theorem, a canonical version of Lovelock theorem that tells you if you want an action which depends only on the metric and is invariant under diffuse, which is second order, you have GR. This is the Hamiltonian analog. If you want to implement the hypersurface deformation algebra, which you can derive on a very geometric, it can be derived just by looking at how hypersurfaces deform and how you don't need to know. You can implement such an algebra also for a scalar field on a spacetime in arbitrary coordinate where the spacetime is a background. You don't need necessarily H to be part of your phase space to write down something like that. You can implement it on any phase space, in fact, of any field theory. That's how it was discovered by Dirac. But if you try to implement it on the phase space of GR itself, where H is one of the phase space variables, then because of this field dependence, this structure is extremely rigid, and there is only one way to satisfy it. And the way is to, basically, you can reconstruct that horrible function over there just from these equations, which is quite crazy. Okay, so it also tells you, moreover, this is GR. With the dynamics and four diffeo invariants. So basically, this theorem gives you the last arrow in our diagram up there and closes the circle. So to conclude, from where I started, if you want to quantize GR, and then with all its symmetries, you have to find a way to quantize this algebra, which is extremely challenging. First, it's not an algebra. It's highly nonlinear. And so on and so forth. And in particular, if you managed, you would have incidentally also solved GR's dynamic, essentially, because this algebra fully encodes the theory. So it's not too surprising, maybe, that if you try to quantize the structure of that, quantizing it is extremely, extremely challenging, because it contains everything. It's like if you know the Hilbert space, the reduced Hilbert space of this thing, you know exactly the space of solutions of full nonlinear general relativity. So you cannot separate the implementation of the symmetries, which usually regarded as something crucial that you need to do to not break your your system, in a sense, and a perturbative approach to dynamics, because the two are extremely intertwined. So that's what Bianca has been doing for many, many years, trying to find decent approximation schemes for where you can preserve something, not everything, but still make sense of what's going on. OK, I think this is good.
imposing quantization on this Poisson bracket structure would be quantizing GR, but in vacuum. But my question is, like, when we go to Planck scale energies, is it correct to assume that we don't have matter fields?
Oh, okay. So very good. You can. Of course, when you quantize, I think this is there are two separate points of view on this question. You could say maybe the fact that quantizing gravity is relevant only at very high energies, and at very high energies I would excite all possible matter fields, maybe the only consistent way of dealing with this system is to quantize all at once in a unified theory. That's a valid perspective, and you can't disprove it by a classical analysis or anything. In a way, the postulate behind theories that try to address quantum gravity first is to say, oh, I can. They see it as a mathematical problem of just finding a quantum representation of this algebra, if you want, or maybe a path integral quantization of GR or something, and then putting quantum matter fields on top of it later. So in many of these approaches, you end up working in a discrete theory, which can be seen as a regularization that then you have to understand how to remove, but in certain senses, that would be a bit of a rabbit hole to talk about discretization, but let's take it for granted for a second. Then you can maybe add matter on top as you would in a lattice theory. And then, of course, the renormalization flows and everything would be changed, but you're coupling quantum gravitational degrees of freedom with quantum matter degrees of freedom. You don't need to, you're quantizing electrons and the Maxwell field independently and then looking at them in a coupled system. But you don't need to, you're not unifying spinners with Maxwell fields. Now, for gravity, maybe that's not correct. Who knows? But the philosophy in many of the, in those approaches is to say, oh, we did it many, many times already. We quantize Maxwell on its own, Young-Mills on its own, and then we added quarks, electrons on top, quantize on their own, and we found something that works. So why not trying the same here? And let's simplify the problem and treat it separately. Another thing that this is interesting to think about is about emergent approaches. In emergent approaches, you think, oh, I can maybe find gravity at coming out of a bit of nowhere by other degrees of freedom, but where are they moving these degrees of freedom and so on? So if the fundamental theory is a theory of some degrees of freedom in a background, then it's quite challenging to find background independence at large scale. Like conceptually is a bit of a puzzle. And partly, in a sense, here you have such a nice symmetry structure that contains everything. And there, this should emerge from something that is non-general covariance on its own. And if it were general covariance from the beginning, you are essentially putting in the, like, this emergent approach from this perspective, theorem tells you that general covariance, or Lovelock theorem, is strong enough a principle to give you GR up to higher order corrections, higher derivatives. Now, if either the fundamental theory is general covariant or not, if it is general covariant, then it's pointless to talk about emergence of gravity. It must be there in some form already. Maybe there are more degrees of freedom that then gets washed out by renormalization and stuff like this. But if you think about emergence in a more fundamental way, from something that is not general covariant to start with, then the big challenge is to recover general covariance at low energies, and it becomes a hard problem again. yeah, I don't have much to say about it. I'm not saying it's impossible. But it's also, it looks like a bit of a shame. It's like trying to recover Minkowski invariants from some Lorentz invariant from the ether theory, right? It kind of goes a bit against what we learned so far. By the way, Bell wrote a nice paper where he says you can interpret special relativity in terms of physical contractions and so on. So it might be actually a useful perspective for certain things. So I'm not, again, it's just, I want to throw puzzles more than answers when it comes to quantum gravity, because I don't know what the right way of doing things is. But having in mind what the challenges are, I think is good for the perspective. Well, thanks so much for attending the course.